This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, the United Nations Committee Against Torture released a report that called for the United States to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. The 11-page report condemned the detention site as well as secret CIA prisons as a violation of international law. And it's not just the UN. British Attorney General Peter Goldsmith, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said it's time for Guantanamo to go. The United States opened Camp X-Ray at Guantanamo in January 2002 to hold prisoners the Department of Defense described as the worst of the worst. Soon afterwards, reports of mistreatment and torture emerged. And while physical conditions at Guantanamo have improved considerably, the UN Committee report concludes that holding men indefinitely amounts to a form of torture. The U.S. denies any abuse or torture and maintains the right, indeed the obligation, to hold men who vowed to return to the battle against the U.S. if they're released. If Guantanamo's closed, the Bush administration asks, what happens to these dangerous enemy combatants? Later in the program, we'll talk with economist Robert Shiller about the cooling market for residential real estate and a new index that will establish a market for housing futures. But first, is it time to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay? If you have questions on the status of the prisoners or about possible solutions to the quandary, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And we begin with NPR's Jackie Northam, who's been covering the situation at Guantanamo. She's with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Neil.
It's one thing for human rights organizations to denounce Guantanamo Bay, as they have for a number of years now. It's another when it's the UN and two important American allies. Is this having any effect in Washington?
Well, not a lot. Let's put it that way. I think there is some lip service being paid to all these calls to close the prison camp, certainly. And in fact, just earlier this month, President Bush on German television said that, you know, he would like to close it, but he's just waiting for the Supreme Court decision regarding the legality of these military tribunals. There's also been some, comments by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, also her spokesman. You get a little bit of this coming out. Last time I was down there, though, Neil, I was astonished at how there is no sense of tearing down this operation. In fact, just the opposite. They've completed Camp 5, which is a hard-walled prison where they keep detainees with what they have, the high intelligence value. They're building another hard-walled prison. There's a brand-new, huge intelligence building that is up and finished now. There's a psychiatric, new psychiatric ward for the detainees down there. There's wind turbines that are producing about 30% of the island's electricity. Not the island, excuse me.
The bases.
The camp. The base's electricity. So again, there is no sense that this place is going to collapse at any time soon.
And President Bush said, as you mentioned, he's waiting for this a Supreme Court ruling, which I guess comes next month, we think. But that would only, the United States only plans to put hold military tribunals, if they're allowed, on some of the prisoners.
Yeah, it's amazing how many qualifiers there are to anything that you say about Guantanamo, isn't it? Yes, that's right. In fact, only 10 people have been charged there, and you get conflicting reports about how many others they plan to charge, anywhere from 24 more up to 75 more. Now, this is interesting because you have almost 500 people being detained there. Again, you get layer upon layer, but essentially out of those, they have these review tribunals as to whether a detainee represents a threat or still has intelligence value. And it seems that 140 detainees are looking good to get out. In other words, they'll either be transferred to their home country or released somehow. So they're trying to get rid of some of them. They're trying to put some of them on trial, but there's a whole lot more that we just don't know what's going to happen to them yet. It's a very complicated situation right now.
And their status is enemy combatant. Is that equivalent to prisoner of war?
Oh, boy, that's where you get into trouble, isn't it? I mean, prisoner of war denotes that the Geneva Conventions would apply down at Guantanamo. And as we all know, they do not apply. The president has made that very clear. At the same time, he makes it very clear that the spirit of the Geneva Conventions is actually applied down there. So enemy combatant is a term that was formulated since 9/11, since the so-called war on terrorism began. And there's always been some sort of conflict and controversy as to what it exactly means. But down there at Guantanamo Bay, what it means is people that the government still feels represent either a threat to America and would either hurt Americans or the allies again, or have some sort of intelligence value.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to be speaking with a member of the United Nations Committee Against Torture in just a minute. As you know, they released a report last week calling for Guantanamo to be closed. Can you remind us what this argument was about?
This argument came. It's just really looking at whether or not torture was there. This State Department's legal counsel, John Bellinger, said that the committee had gone far beyond its mandate by calling for the closure of Guantanamo, because the Americans also argued that just holding people indefinitely does not constitute torture. Therefore, they had gone out of their mandate in saying that as well. But essentially saying it was open-ended detentions, it was essentially saying that, you know, forms of cruelty and torture had been used at Guantanamo and various other things. I want to say right here, though, and they actually talked about using secret prisons. It went beyond mm-hmm. Guantanamo. But as far as Guantanamo itself goes, you know, you talk to the International Committee of the Red Cross, you talk to Human Rights Watch, and they say that in Guantanamo, they've cleaned up their act, essentially, as far as torture goes. Now, it depends on how you define torture. Some people, and in fact, the ICRC says torture, open-ended detentions is a form of torture. And so there is torture going on, but it's not this waterboarding that we used to see, or, you know, allegations of that used to go on there, any of this other stuff. Apparently, it's much, much better there, but they still are having open-ended detentions, and there's a problem with force-feeding any of the detainees that are on hunger strike. But other than that, they seem to think that they've cleaned up their act a lot.
Mm-hmm. Jackie Northam, thanks very much.
Thank you.
NPR's Jackie Northam with us here in Studio 3A. Nora Sveos is an independent expert and a member of the 10-person panel that makes up the United Nations Committee Against Torture. She's also a psychologist and head of the Research Unit on Refugees and Forced Migration at the Norwegian Center of the Study of Violence and Traumatic Stress in Oslo, Norway. She's with us now by phone from her home in Oslo. Good of you to take the time this evening to speak with us.
Hello, hello.
Yes.
Thank you for inviting me to the program.
What evidence did you and the panel examine to come to your conclusions?
I would like to start by saying some words about the context of this work, because the U.S. is one of the 141 countries in the world that has ratified the Torture Convention, and by doing so, the state parties, as it's called, are obliged to present the reports to the committees every 4 years, describing how the countries are complying with the provisions of the convention. So this year in May, we actually had 7 state parties filing their reports, so besides the U.S., Guatemala, Peru, Korea, Georgia, Togo, and Qatar. So the questions that we place to them is always the same: how the state parties fulfill the obligations with respect to an absolute prohibition of torture, what's done to prevent torture and inhuman and degrading treatment from happening, and if it and when it happens, how are these instances investigated, how are the responsible prosecuted and punished, and how are the victims provided with redress and compensation. So to your question, the work of the committee is actually to be in dialogue with the states and support them in fulfilling these obligations. And in relation to the U.S., you probably all know the U.S. government sent a very large and a high-level delegation to comment and respond upon the questions that we posed to them in relation to their very long and thorough report. So in Geneva, we had the opportunity to discuss these issues. So the conclusions of the committee that came out after the meeting, or towards the end of the meeting, are actually based upon the information provided by the U.S. itself, both oral and written, together with information that was given to the committee by human rights non-governmental organizations, both nationally and internationally.
Mm-hmm. As you know, the U.S. State Department's legal advisor, John Bellinger, who led the delegation, claims that there were factual errors in your report and that mm-hmm. the committee did not acknowledge changes made over the past 4 years.
Mm. Yes, I've taken notice. He has seen that. But I just want to come back to some of the issues that Brez, because during this work, we actually highlighted a lot of different things, and we did, in the beginning of the report, also underlined the importance of some things that have, in fact, changed. For instance, the signing of the Detainee Treatment Act in 2005, mm-hmm. which clearly prohibits cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment and punishment for every person, regardless of nationality or physical location, in the custody or under the physical control of the state party. So this was an important thing that we definitely clearly acknowledged, as we did with the Prison Rape Elimination Act of 2003, with a zero tolerance for rape in detention facilities. Mm-hmm. So these things were highlighted, but of course, and I'm aware of his comments, but some of the issues that we had that were of concern, even after having discussed it with him, is the actual fact that there are still a number of allegations also within the domestic detention centers in the U.S. as to excessive force, as to long-term isolation, supermax, the use of teasers, continued instances of rape and sexual violence. And also there has been allegations of not sufficient remedy when these things have happened. So, of course, these are concerns that we have. But, of course, the thing that has raised a lot of importance, at least internationally, is our conclusion or our comments with regard to Guantanamo. So, I mean, we've been saying that the work to stop terrorism, of course, is a big issue of high priority, and responsible to acts of terrorism definitely should be held accountable. And it's a serious threat, but the war on terror can never be fought by torture or cruel, degrading, and inhuman treatment.
And we just have another minute with you. And you've said that indefinite imprisonment is a form of torture, yet what is the United States to do with these people who vowed to return to the battlefield to fight the U.S. if they're released?
Well, I think the important thing is that we have defined, and this is not only in this case, this is in a number of other cases, that prolonged and indefinite detention is not only a form of torture, it's what we'd call cruel, degrading, and inhuman treatment. So we have referred to Article 16 in the Convention with regard to this. So our contention here is very clear that we should permit the detainees to have judicial processes or release them if no charges can be put forth, but also ensure them that they're not sent back to areas where they can be exposed to torture again. So it's not that people should not be processed judicially. Everybody should do that. So the problem is, as was also mentioned earlier here, that there are neither defined as criminal nor as war
as prisoners of war. Yes.
So.
I'm afraid we're out of time,
and
we've agreed to let you go, so we'll do so. Thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you very much.
Nora Sveaas joined us today from her home in Oslo. More on this after a break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay was opened to hold the war on terror's so-called worst of the worst, but a United Nations committee and even America's European allies want it shut down. They argue it's a violation of international law. The U.S. denies that and says there's no place else for these prisoners to go. You're invited to join our conversation. If you have questions on the status of the prisoners or about possible solutions to this quandary, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. David Rivkin has served in several legal and policy positions in the Reagan and George Bush senior administrations. He's now a partner at Baker and Hostetler here in Washington, D.C. He says the U.N. report is unconvincing as a matter of law, and he joins us now by phone from his office here in Washington. Nice to have you on the program today.
Good to be with you, Neil.
From a legal perspective, what problems do you have with the U.N. report?
It is absolutely not based upon any provision of a torture convention, its legislative history, or any legal argument that's been put forward by anybody. And let me be clear, let's take off the table of a discussion about interrogation techniques and what kind of interrogation treatment amounts to cruel, inhumane, degrading punishment. Reasonable people can disagree about that. What reasonable people cannot disagree about is the simple proposition that in time of war, it is absolutely legal, indeed I would argue it's compelled, once you capture an enemy combatant, to detain this person for the duration of hostilities, to ensure, not quite often people think it's to get intelligence, that's actually not the key factor. The key factor, and you got into it a little bit in your previous conversation, is to make sure you're not running a revolving door, that people you capture don't go back to fighting. And particularly, the reason I would say it's not only a legal right, but a duty, because the people we're fighting against now have pioneered as their preferred combat technique the killing of civilians. So for the United States to actually release people who are known to kill civilians and who are certain or highly likely to go back to killing civilians is actually, to me, an unlawful act.
Yet, as you heard, the member of the committee, the UN Committee Against Torture, say unless you're going to designate these people as prisoners of war, then they have to be either charged and put in prison for crimes they've committed, charged in front of a regular legal process, or released.
But to put it mildly, she does not know what she's talking about, and it has nothing to do with torture convention. Torture convention doesn't even govern this area of the law. Under the laws of war, which, again, not anything recent, not anything invented by the administration, which is several hundred years old, there have always been two categories of people. Lawful combatants who, upon capture, are treated as honorable POWs, are entitled to all sorts of benefits and privileges. And these are people, Neil, who, prior to capture, behave themselves in accordance with laws and customs of war, because you want to incentivize people to do that. And then you have unlawful combatants who, upon capture, do not get POW status, who in the past have been treated very harshly, basically killed out of hand, who are now certainly, even prior to World War II, began to get a more humane treatment, but nothing approaching level of POW protections, because, again, you want to disincentivize, you want to stigmatize the behavior of these people engaged in the battlefield, because the basic goal in laws of war area is to ensure that you don't have people who kill civilians. There's absolutely nothing in a torture convention or any other document, including the 1949 Geneva Conventions, that requires that everybody be either a POW or criminal suspect. So with all due respect, there's absolutely no merit in this argument. It's not even a serious argument. And as to detaining people indefinitely, POWs, for the benefit of the members of that committee, are also detained indefinitely, meaning what? You never know how long the war would last. If you ask Winston Churchill, for example, in 1941 how long the war would last, he'll probably throw you out of his office because he didn't know. Did we know how long Civil War would last, or World War I, or Korea? No. So by definition, in the laws of war paradigm, every time you detain captured combatants, lawful or unlawful, they're being detained indefinitely.
Yet I think
reinvented the law. She has abolished the laws of war by saying that indefinite detention amounts to cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment.
Yet the war on terror, I think you have to admit, is a special case. I mean, who decides when that's over? That seems to be indefinite. Doesn't seem to be the start of it.
Well, that is a very good point. If in fact, as a matter of law, the relevant yardstick was the duration of a war on terror, because you're absolutely right, Neil. There's going to be war on poverty and war on terror for a long, long time. But that's not the relevant legal yardstick. The relevant legal framework is the war against specific enemy combatant organizations like Al-Qaeda and Taliban. And international law actually does have an objective test, and then this conflict would be over. Because the critics often say, well, you're not going to have a surrender that you've had with nation states.
Right.
The traditional standard is, when have we degraded the ability of enemy combatant organizations to offer effective resistance? Doesn't mean no resistance, doesn't mean no attacks, but effective resistance. That may take, frankly, a long time. With all due respect, wars have gone on for a long time in the past, for years and years and years. The problem, to put it very simply, what this committee manifests, aside from utter legal ignorance about laws of war and utter hubris by presuming that the Torture Convention even governs this area, is basically a wholesale rejection of the laws of war paradigm and the view that these people are no different from criminal suspects, in which case we would be absolutely right. With criminal suspects, you got to give them speedy trials, you got to charge them, prosecute them, convict them, or release them. And holding criminal suspects indefinitely is indeed a form of cruel, inhumane, degrading punishment. But this is not a criminal justice problem. And the same philosophical problem bedevils Lord Goldsmith and every other critic.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And we'll start with Chuck. Chuck calling from San Francisco.
Very much. I really love a chance to address the point that was just made, but my question has to do with, what do we know about the people that are being held at Guantanamo? We've heard they're the worst of the worst, but I've also heard that a lot of them were just kind of picked up on the battlefield, and so what do we got here, terrorist masterminds or, you know, 19-year-old Taliban?
Frankly speaking, both. But let me just add that under the laws of war, you can detain cooks and people who engage in telegraphy and tend to the wagons and clean the weapons, as well as the guys who charge uphill with with fixed bayonets, because all of those people contribute to the war effort. Again,
yeah, okay.
This is not a question of just capturing the masterminds. If you look at the POW camps in World War I and World War II, most of the folks were conscripts who probably did not particularly want to be there and didn't do anything wrong. So that's the way it's supposed to be. And one other point worthy of note, we've released over 260 folks from Guantanamo out of original population of 600-plus. At least several dozen of them have gone back to fighting against senior Taliban commander and bragged about it, about how we fooled the Americans. And that, to me, just suggests that people who think they're all innocent shepherds should just take a deep breath and look at the facts.
Jack, go ahead.
It seems to me if a good many of them are just kind of the sort of people who joined the Army because that seemed like the best thing for them to do at the time, it's not terribly surprising to say that after being held for a couple of years, maybe being tortured, they might return to the battlefield. But that seems rather circular reasoning. But it seems to me that if you do a cost-benefit analysis, the benefit is you keep a bunch of people who don't like us very much off the battlefield when there are, you know, thousands more just like them out there that we don't have in custody. And you consider that maybe whatever intelligence value most of these people ever had is probably pretty stale now. You got to balance that against the cost. And it seems to me that some of the costs have to do with U.S. prestige and moral authority, considering a lot of people think this erodes our moral authority. And given that the war on terror is, among many things, a battle of ideas, that moral authority may be more valuable than keeping a couple of people that don't like us out of commission or whatever stale intelligence value some of these guys have.
Well, the short answer is you would be absolutely right if we were just picking people at random who happen to dislike us, and unfortunately there are millions of people around the world who do not like it. A lot of them happen to be animated by radical Islamist ideology, but that's not what's going on. The people who have been picked up, and let's again assume for a second there's no mistaken identity, that indeed they are who we believe they are, which are people who have taken up arms against us. With all due respect, the way it's always been from time immemorial, when people took arms against you, even lawful combatants, you basically kept them on ice for however long the conflict went, because it's not just their personal dislike for you. You don't want to be able to return back to the same structures, to the same organizations that provided an opportunity for them to fight. If you run a revolving door, this war indeed would never end. And the last thing I would say in terms of our reputation, frankly, there are unfortunately a lot of people in the world who would not be satisfied with anything we do short of rolling over and playing dead. Mm-hmm. So I'm not, to me, the argument that we should, yes, there are some people who took arms against us, but they're kind of pitiful, they're kind of not very threatening, let them go. How would you like to explain to the family of somebody these people killed upon being released, especially if they happen to be civilians? Well, we just felt they were not that threatening, and, you know, I should be the world's jailer.
Amnesty International came out with its annual report today. It called for the Bush administration to close the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay, as it has in the past. Larry Cox is executive director of Amnesty International. He joins us now from Amnesty's offices here in Washington. Larry, nice to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
I know you've been listening to what David Rifkin have to say. Is it possible that the U.S. Is not in violation of international law? What is it supposed to do with people it's picked up on the battlefield?
Well, our position is very simple, and it's in accord with the 10 independent experts on the Committee Against Torture, the Special Rapporteur on Torture, the European Parliament. It's amazing to me that someone can sort of assert that all of these people are ignorant, don't know the rules of war, don't know human rights. The position is very clear. You should either charge these people with crimes, and if they are guilty of crimes, they should certainly be charged, and they should be given a fair trial, and if guilty, convicted. Or you have to let them go. People don't give up their human rights regardless of what label is put on them. And it's a basic human right to have charges against you and to be able to be proven guilty if you are guilty, or proven innocent if you are innocent.
That would include the people who said, we will return to fight the United States wherever we may go and continue this conflict?
Well, one of the things that's very problematic about this is, of course, we don't know what people are saying. That's the reason we have trials. That's the reason we have a fair process. The U.S. has been saying from the beginning that these are the worst of the worst. That's a presumption of guilt. not a presumption of innocence. Then it releases people. As the speaker just said, they've released hundreds of people. So apparently they weren't the worst of the worst, because I can't imagine that if they were the worst of the worst, they would release. There is lots of evidence that some of these people are, in fact, people who were simply picked up because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. We don't know. We don't know because there is no process to find out. And the process that has been suggested that is being held up because of the Supreme Court decision is not a process that's fair that would allow us to find out. So all we're asking for is that there, what every human being has a right to, which is that if you are accused of something, there has to be some process which gives you a chance and gives us all a chance to find out if those accusations are correct or not correct. The fact that you can be held for 4 years without charges, without knowing when you will ever be released, not as a prisoner of war, but as something called an enemy combatant, is clearly, in my opinion, and in the opinion of most of the legal experts, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment.
Can I just jump in for one second?
If you would hold on for just a moment, please, sir. We're talking with David Rivkin, who's a partner in the law office of Baker and Hostetler and worked in several legal and policy positions in the Reagan and George Bush I administrations, and with Larry Cox, executive director of Amnesty International. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Mr. Rivkin, please.
Yes. My only point to Larry is that if you look at the procedures, they've been accorded to POWs, millions of them, as a matter of fact, German, French, American, in World War II, for example. None of them was charged with anything. Well, most of them were not. None of them got access to lawyers. None of them knew if they were captured in 1941 or 42 about how long they were kept. Larry, once again, and it illustrates perfectly the difference between the critics and the administration, absolutely confuses the laws of war paradigm, but does not envision any such things. All that the laws of war require that you get, in case of doubt, at the front end, some level of due process to contest your claim that, let's say, you're not an enemy combatant, you're not a tanker, you're not an airman, you're not an infantryman, you're an innocent shepherd who just wandered onto the battlefield and he was snatched by somebody. And you, I can assure you, that the people in Guantanamo got more due process with all the review procedures. Not as much, I don't want to tell your listeners, as much as you get in the criminal process. Not as much at all. But more process than any POW in the history of warfare ever gotten. And that's still not enough. Because nothing would be enough, because they basically do not believe that this is war and these are enemy combatants.
Larry Cox?
Well, first of all, these are not prisoners of war, as I think you pointed out. So they're in some kind of legal limbo that the administration has, in my opinion, created, and which has been repudiated by most legal experts that I'm aware of,
unlawful enemy
including
combatant
the dean of
status.
Law at Yale Law School.
Unlawful enemy combatant.
Lewis Hankin, who is
around
one of the
wait.
I could go on and on. So these are not prisoners of war. You would have been in a better position, I think, and U.S. moral authority would have been stronger had they been treated as prisoners of war. And when the conflict, particularly the conflict in Afghanistan, ended, had they been released. These are undoubtedly some people who have committed acts of terror. If they have committed acts of terror, not if you speculate that someday they may commit acts of terror, but if they have committed acts of terror, been part of an organization that have committed acts of terror, they should be charged. And we should find out what they did, and they should, if they are guilty, they should be prosecuted. That's what all we're demanding. No one is demanding a revolving door. But 4 years of holding people who have not been charged is, as the committee who has the responsibility to interpret the convention, which has been signed and ratified by the United States, has said, is cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And the cost, as one of your listeners pointed out, for the United States' ability to fight the war on terror effectively, to intervene in other situations that demand U.S. moral leadership, has been severely undermined by Guantanamo. And whatever the rationale originally for having it or for thinking it would be useful, it has long, long outlived that usefulness and is doing immense harm to the U.S. moral authority in the world, which has historically been an authority very valuable for the protection and advancement of human rights. So we're not trying to bash the United States. We're trying to get the United States to restore some of the moral authority it's lost, both for the sake of other situations and for the sake of the fight of the war against terror.
We're not going to solve this argument today. It will continue, as indeed looks like the camp at Guantanamo Bay is intended at least to be there for some time. But, gentlemen, thank you very much, both of you, for being with us today. We were talking with Larry Cox, Executive Director of Amnesty International. Their annual report came out earlier today. And with David Rifkin, who served in several legal and policy positions in the Reagan and George Bush senior administrations, now a partner in the law office of Baker and Hostetler here in Washington, D.C. When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about a new tool to track the cooling housing market and about trading housing futures. Plus, what's going on Wall Street. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.